That's John Latimer. I'm Heidi Holton. It's Tuesday morning on KEXE, and it's time to continue our conversation on forest history, this segment produced by Mark Jacobs. Mark is here today along with Kurt Brown. He's an author and historian from the Minnesota Star Tribune, and today we are learning about the Cloquet Fire of 1918. Good morning, Kurt. Good morning, Mark. Thanks for being here.
Good morning, Heidi and Mark.
Good morning.
John, nice to be joining you on your program today.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for joining us. I'm thrilled to have you aboard. I can't wait to learn more about this fire in Cloquet. I think everybody, well, not everybody, but certainly a lot of our listeners have heard of the Hinckley Fire, but many of us have just kind of passed over that fire in the Cloquet area. Can you sort of set the scene? What was the situation before the fire?
Well, this was 1918, and it was the driest summer they'd experienced in that area of northeastern Minnesota in 48 years. It was just a kind of a brittle powder keg ready to go. The forests had been so chopped down, and the slash piles had been growing. And remember, World War One was underway in 1918, so you had a lot of the guys who would typically maybe be working for the railroads, checking the tracks to make sure the slash piles were under control. Those guys were off fighting in the trenches of France, so that didn't help the situation at all. And when October came that year again, after a bone-dry summer, the scene was set for what became the worst natural disaster in Minnesota state history. And I was, like you, I was, you know, more aware of the Hinckley Fire, which maybe covered more areas, but more people died in the 1918 fire in northeastern Minnesota than any other natural disaster in the state. More than 450 people were killed. Ooh. And 21,000 were injured, and 52,000 people were displaced. And most of those were immigrants, Finns and Swedes and Scandinavian types that had come to the area because it kind of reminded them of home in the old country.
And I think it's instructive that you mentioned the railroads, and that was, I don't know that in this case that was the source of the fire, but in those days, those steam engines, when they went to power, why, they threw a lot of stuff out of the stack that was not completely burnt.
Now, the railroads were really kind of an interesting character in the whole story in the book that I wrote, because they did indeed get blamed for causing the fire. The conductors of these trains were supposed to put little grills on top of the smokestacks to keep the big ashes and embers from starting fires like this one. But that kind of slowed them down. It slowed the drag down. And so a lot of them just kind of disregarded the rules and went about. But it was sparked something in the Brookston area, kind of north of the Moose Lake area where the fire began. And then with winds, it whipped way out of control and ended up covering 1,500 square miles, nearly 100,000 acres. And although you called it the Cloquet Fire, it's really Moose Lake and that Kettle River area and Cloquet all suffered. But as bad as the railroads were, and the government eventually was blamed, because World War One was going on in 1918, the government had taken over and nationalized the railroads. So they ended up getting blamed for starting the fire. But at the same time, the trains rescued more than 5,000 people in Cloquet. The amount of deaths in Cloquet was relatively low compared to the other surrounding areas, and those evacuation trains were really heroic. So the trains were both the hero and the villain of the 1918 fires.
How did that work? So the people in Cloquet would run down to the station and get on a train?
They piled on the trains and boxcars. So there's some great anecdotes about, you know, prim and proper women of the area whose husbands would pick them up and kind of throw them into boxcars. You know, they were used to nice passenger trains, but there was no time for that. So the railroads sent as many trains packed with people as they could to rescue evacuees. And
where were they taking them? What?
Go ahead, I interrupted you.
Where did they take them? Once you got on the train, were you going to Duluth or were you going down to the south or what?
Yeah, no, they were mostly heading south to get out of the way. And the auto traffic too. Cars were relatively a new thing in 1918. And there's a place that is still known as Dead Man's Curve between Kettle River and Moose Lake, a big turn in the highway near, I think it's Highway 73.
I've been around that corner.
And it's changed now. The highway's been a little realigned, but between 75 and 100 people were killed in that area as people piled into pickup trucks and kind of old Model Ts, as many as they could get. And there's just horrific stories. One story involved a young woman, 17-year-old, let me check my notes, Allie Leppa was her name, and she was working for the phone company. She was kind of putting in the buttons at the phone company as the fires grew. And finally, someone convinced her to give up her job at the telephone office and jump into a pickup truck crowded with people. When it came whipping around Dead Man's Curve, the car tipped over and pinned her mother underneath the car. She was injured for the rest of her life, but they survived and kind of ran from the forests. And she finally, exhausted with smoke, couldn't see anything, and sat down on what she thought was a soft log, only to realize that was one of her friends from high school's body that she'd been sitting on. So the horrific stories are almost too much. You know, my job as an author was to just kind of be the gatekeeper and figure out which stories got in and which stories didn't make it. And a lot of those stories, interestingly enough, were handed down in the saunas. A lot of these Finnish immigrants I mentioned, you know, years later didn't really want to talk about it. But a guy named Manny, who was a Finnish banker in the area, who kind of recorded their stories in the 60s, would go hit the saunas with them where people were more relaxed and the stories would start to...
I don't know how you could talk about a huge fire like that in a sauna. That seems to me to be like, yeah, thank you, no. It's hot enough in here.
The Cloquet area, like you say, Cloquet and Moose Lake, but the fire went west even over to McGregor and almost to Palisade and north to Floodwood. It covered quite an area in spots. I have a map of it that shows the extent of it, and it's pretty widespread.
Yeah, it made it all the way to the west to Aiken County, and it could have been as horrible as it was with 450 deaths and thousands injured and displaced. It made it all the way up to Duluth and to the Lakewood area, kind of ran into the lake, and the typography of the Duluth area, just those rocky hills, kind of helped save Duluth. If Duluth would have been engulfed in this flame, it would have really been a kind of San Francisco earthquake kind of disaster.
I think it's probably worthwhile to point out that most of the structures that would have been in the path of this fire were probably made of wood, and it just, you know, they were not going to stand up to any kind of a fire. They weren't brick or mortar or anything like that.
And October 12th was the day, and as you know, in northern Minnesota, winter's not too far down the road, so a lot of these displaced people... The government gave them lumber and kind of tar paper to put up shacks for the winter that was just around the corner. So, you know, imagine slapping together a little shack to make it through a Minnesota winter. And that's what thousands of people had to do in the northeastern Minnesota fire zone.
And a lot of, I suspect that, I mean, most of these people were subsistence farming. So they would have lost all of their livestock. They probably would have lost their root cellar, which had all of their farm, you know, all of their garden produce. How do you get through a winter with nothing? I mean, with just a shack.
Well, and it's actually kind of the story, the saga of the post-fire was, to me, some of the most interesting research that I came across, because it took 35 years. You know, people would kind of submit their list of lost livestock, lost housing, what they'd lost. And early on, the government and the railroads offered to pay them half. You know, like if you said, I lost $5,000, they'd say, you can have $2,500 now. And a lot of them were desperate and took that early offer. Those who hung out there and fought in Congress for 35 years, it took until FDR finally gave them their full restitution of what they were owed. So it was one of the first times that regular people had kind of gathered and fought the railroads and the government and demanded to get what was fair, because, again, the railroads were blamed for causing the fires. And it was not until the 30s that FDR signed a bill that restored what they'd lost. So it's kind of a fascinating history of tenacity for the folks who kept fighting for what was right.
Kurt, you talked about World War I, but there was also a pandemic at that time, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, when I the Minnesota Historical Society Press commissioned me to write this book for the 100th anniversary of 1918. That's why it's called Minnesota 1918. And at the time, it was kind of an obscure book. I didn't know anything really about, not much about World War I, very little about the flu pandemic of 1918, and very little about the fire. And so we kind of braided that together. I suggested the title would be Trifecta of Woe, but they decided not. That one. But then all of a sudden, you know, after the book came out and was completed, you know, we get hit with COVID-19, the worst pandemic we'd seen since 1918. Although the 1918 flu, if you crunch the numbers, was probably about three times more deadly than the COVID experience we just went through in 2020. So you really had three, you know, horrible things happening all at the same time and converging on Minnesota. Really, the peak of the flu pandemic came that fall. There were kind of three waves, but the most deadly was right around October, which is when the war was going on overseas and the fires were burning up by Cloquet and Moose Lake. So, you know, I think if Minnesotans could get through those three things, we can get through anything.
We are talking today with Kurt Brown, author and historian from the Minnesota Star Tribune. The book he's talking about, Minnesota 1918, When Flu, Fire, and War Ravaged the State, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. So, Kurt, do you feel like there were things that we learned from the tragic fire in 1918?
I kind of think just the opposite, Heidi. You know, when I look back, this is more than 100 years ago now, 107 years ago. And what have we learned? You know, in my own personal life, you know, I become kind of numb watching stories about the Maui fire and all these hurricanes that ravaged the South. And then my own daughter's home in Altadena, California, burned to the ground this January.
Oh, no.
You know, all suffering from the post-COVID epidemic, you know, so, and we have two wars kind of raging in Europe, in the Middle East, and in the Russians and the Ukrainians are at war. So what have we learned? You know, they say history repeats itself, and it certainly has. I mean, you wonder what's changed as fires continue to ravage, you know, California, maybe where I live now in Colorado, it's going to be a dangerous fire season. We had another dry winter without much snow. So you wonder, what have we learned? And, you know, the epidemics were very similar. There was a whole non-masking league that came out back in 1918 that thought everyone was making too big a deal of COVID. And we saw that repeated in 2020. And so, you know, what have we learned? I would say very little. Sadly.
Yeah, live and don't learn. I'm curious, how long did this fire persist and how did it get put out?
Yeah, it was really just the winds and weathers and it kind of burned itself out. It was basically one day, October 12th of 1918, that one, you know, the fires were horrible. I have a little description I could
tell
you.
Yes, please.
This woman, Allie Leppa, who ended up sitting on what she thought was a log, you know, and she just described the, you know, seeing the fire on the horizon just burning kind of out of control. And they thought they were the only people alive. One little anecdote story, another tragic little anecdote, and involved a guy from Autumba whose name was John Arvid Kurtu. He was the postmaster of the little town of Autumna, which then was a bigger lumber town. Now it still exists, but there's only a handful of people who live there between Kettle River and Moose Lake. He was 42 years old, and he was described as 5'3", stout man with brown hair and a roundish face. He was not only the postmaster of the little town, but he also was a taxidermist, and he had been making land and timber lease arrangements. So when the fire started, he put his wife and his three kids on one of these evacuation trains, but he decided to go back to the office to collect some valuable business papers and his cash box. Well, he stayed too long on the road to Kalevala, where his office was. The escape routes were all cut off. Fires and flames were coming from both ways. So he decided not to be engulfed by the flames, he pulled out his pistol and shot himself in the head. And when rescuers came the next day, they found him in a pile of sawdust, and the fires never reached him. So it was a kind of a tragic story. He literally jumped the gun in that case. I shouldn't joke about it. But the amount of stories that have been passed down, you know, just kind of blew me away as I continued to do the research. And one interesting, I don't know, aspect for me was that the Native Americans in the Fond du Lac Ojibwe Chippewa Reservation recorded no deaths, even though they were right in the middle of that fire zone. You know, so those people, indigenous people, had been around for centuries and kind of knew fire and knew what to do when it was coming and knew when to get out. While the Finns and some of these Swedish newcomers and Norwegians who had just kind of came to the area were a little less, they had a little less historical context and a little less instincts of what to do. And, you know, there's one story, and I start my book with, I went up to the Moose Lake area, and there's a gentleman who I was having coffee with, and, you know, like all fires, some houses survived, and his grandfather's house had survived, and he was 82 years old, and there was a story about a family that all went into one of the root cellars, kind of a brick igloo that they put their potatoes and their meat in there to cure, and they had put all the kids in there and thrown buckets of water as the fire came through and hoped that that would keep the family safe. There was a little air pipe, so they yelled in there, "Are you okay?" And they got no response. And when they ended up opening that door, they found 16 people. The fire had sucked the oxygen out of that, that root cellar. And I was led to that area. There's no sign, there's no memorial or anything, but one of the local guys at the time, when I was doing my research, we walked through the woods for about a quarter mile, and there it was. And I crept in there and turned on my cell phone flashlight, and it was a very eerie feeling to go into that dark, that dark, like I say, kind of igloo where 16 people had turned into a root cellar, turned into a mausoleum, kind of. So, yeah, the horror was kind of unimaginable today. But like I say, we're seeing similar scenes unfold today, just like they did 107 years ago.
You know, the one thing that I'm curious about, you know, today there are, you know, cell phones and there are radio and television and just all this information. How did these people communicate with one another? How did you know to go left and not right? How did all this happen?
Yeah, you really didn't know. I mean, there were telephones, and that, you know, certainly helped spread the word a little bit. But, you know, a lot of the guys had gone to fight the fires and try to help out. And really, there was no, the job was kind of too big. But that left a lot of the women and children kind of back to fend for themselves. So they were caught way too unaware of the calamity that was to come.
Wow. An amazing story. I'm going to have to get a copy of your book and read this, because it just, it's piqued my curiosity about this.
You know, when we started the book, I was trying to find people, like I said, there were these three calamities that all converged at once, the fire, the war, and the flu. And I was trying to find people that maybe were, you know, characters around which I could, around whom I could wrap a narrative. And we ended up finding so many little anecdotes and people in the little, there's a great little fire museum in Moose Lake that has a lot of great history. So I was getting a lot of kind of little vignettes. So we kind of shifted and did more of a mosaic approach, where we just kind of put together kind of little stories about all these disasters from different parts of the state and tried to string those together. And hopefully when you're done reading all those, you get kind of a sense of what kind of year 1918 was in Minnesota, probably the worst year, I would say, in the history of the state. Although you could go back to 1862 when the Native people and the army was fighting during the Civil War. When
right.
Another chapter of Minnesota history that fascinates me, that 1862 war, but I would argue 1918 maybe was even a worse year for the state.
That is Kurt Brown. The book again is called Minnesota 1918, When Flu, Fire, and War Ravaged the State, published by the Minnesota Historical Society Press. Kurt, thanks for being here, and Mark, thanks for doing it as well.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. That was a great story.
And John, I just have to say, go ahead.
No, you go ahead, Mark.
I was just off topic. I just wanted to tell John you're welcome for me leaving early because that's when the interesting birds show up on field.
Yeah, thank you for that. Kurt, you weren't aware. We were at a gathering together, and Mark had to leave, and shortly after that we ran into a summer tanager, which is an exceedingly rare bird for this part of the world. So yes, but thanks again, Kurt. Thank you for coming and joining us, and thanks for the book. I look forward to reading it.
All right, thanks for reaching out. I appreciate being on your show.